Okay, hi there. My name is David Roberts. I am the senior energy writer, reporter for grist.org. I'm here today with Andrew Revkin, who was until recently the lead science and environment reporter for the New York Times and is now, I'm going to read this so I don't butcher it, a senior fellow for environmental understanding at the Pace University Academy for Applied Environmental Studies, and he also is continuing to write the .earth blog for the opinion page of the New York Times. Andy, how's it going?
Good, you got that right, and that is a mouthful, I know.
So the oil spill, does this make you miss the day-to-day reporting grind, or does it make you happy you got out in time?
It makes me happy I got out in time to some extent. I mean, I've done so many stories that required weeks of field reporting with indeterminate outcome. I mean, it goes all the way back to Flight 800 when I was covering general stuff for the Times in the mid-90s, the crash of Long Island, where it looked like I was going to have to get married at the Marriott Hotel where we were all camped out with the investigators. So, yeah, no, I don't miss that. It's very sad in some ways. I mean, I do enjoy field reporting in other ways. It's really vital to get where people are doing the work. But it can be unbelievably exhausting. And, of course, it's very hard on the family as well when you're kind of like the firefighter communicator. You've got to run.
Right. I know several very exhausted environmental reporters
Yeah, me
right
too.
now. Well, let's catch up real quick on the latest news with the oil spill. As you know, the Top Hat failed, or no, what was it? The Junk Shot? What
Top
is
kill and the junk
what
shot were the
ridiculous,
latest.
right?
Yeah.
What ridiculous term are we on now? The Junk Shot failed. That was the
Right.
attempt to dump a bunch of mud and debris into the well, and
Golf
they just
balls.
couldn't get the pressure they needed to stop it up. So
Unfortunately,
next.
this is all just because there's so many aspects of this that are new to. They hadn't tried many of these things at 5,000 feet depth with water that's barely above freezing and all that kind of thing. So there were some. Ooh, I've got to turn that off. Did you get those little bubbly sounds from Skype just now?
No, I'm not hearing your bubbly sounds.
I got some bubbly sounds. I think when people come in and out of Skype, they bubble. Anyway, if people hear it, they'll deal with it. Sorry.
So the next up is the Lower Marine Riser. There's a P in
Package.
there. Package.
Package.
Lower Marine Riser Package, whereby they cut this riser pipe to remove the crimp from it, and then they put a modified containment dome over it. Last time, the containment dome, a bunch of freezing water rushed in, and then these natural gas hydrates or frozen crystals filled up the dome and made it buoyant, made it float. So now, apparently, with the dome, they're pumping down heated water and antifreeze to keep the dome unfrozen as it attempts to capture the oil.
Well, I wish them luck. It's going to be a tough go.
And the worry, just to catch people up completely on the technical stuff, the worry is when they cut the crimp out of the oil riser pipe, if the crimp is slowing the flow of oil right now, then obviously the oil will flow faster. So they're talking about a 15 to 20% rise in the amount of oil coming out, which they then hope to capture with this dome, which is, as we discovered before, a sketchy undertaking. So there's every possibility that this thing could keep going undaunted, unslowed, until they finish the relief wells, which are supposed to happen in August. Now, how do you are you do you know how much confidence they have in those relief wells? I mean, are those a sure thing?
Well, I haven't heard anyone express doubts about them. They've worked pretty well in the past. There are ways. It seems really incredibly difficult to drill a well, essentially parallel to one, but from a distance, and then kind of intersect at 13 or 14,000 feet below the surface, the seabed.
You would think.
But there are ways to do that. In fact, on .earth, early on, Richard Wilson, a Harvard physicist, one of his former students, came up with one of the ways to do that. It's a there's a radio signal or the electromagnetic signal in the existing well can be seen essentially by the drill coming down from the outside. So there is this fairly decent sense that that's going to work out. But as you say, you know, a month or two or longer of unabated gushing oil between now and then creates huge economic, political, environmental concerns.
Yeah, and there's at least a possibility. I read a couple of things about these relief wells today, and they're fairly confident, but you know, not 100% confident. And as we've seen, they've been confident in a lot of things so far that haven't worked out. And if the relief wells don't work out, that's the list of things that
I posted it on May 1st that some people kind of derided initially when I talked about the use of explosives of various kinds, not just nukes like the Russians have done, but there's other ways. The military has all kinds of ways to utilize explosives as engineering tools. And there's a lot of smart people out there who, if you give them the task and don't define it as a leaking oil well, you just say there's an orifice in the seabed 5,000 feet down that
blow it up.
Certain pressure, what do you do? And that's what I call the Feynman fix. You know, Richard Feynman, the physicist. If you come at this cold and say, here's the problem, how do you fix it? There could be solutions that are outside of BP's box for sure.
Yes, those will be interesting times.
I do not anticipate President Obama being the guy who orders the first peacetime nuclear well stanching procedure.
That'd been something nobody predicted way back when.
Oh.
So that's the technical part. Our best guess now is August when the relief wells are done. That's assuming that hurricanes don't come along and delay the relief wells. They're predicting a very active hurricane season, which starts a couple of days, right?
Well, if you count the ones in the eastern Pacific, it started over the weekend when Agatha pummeled Central America and caused this insane sinkhole to open up in Guatemala City that I posted on last night. So, yeah, a lot of rain. You know, anytime you have a hurricane warning, all the ships have to batten down and disengage from pipes and all that kind of stuff and just sort of float free. So that would be incredibly disruptive. And we've seen plenty of seasons with multiple hurricanes in the Gulf. This is not just sort of like there may be a hurricane, as you know. It'd be a big
yeah, they're supposedly normal is 4 to 5 or something like that, and they're predicting something on the order of 7 or 8. Don't quote me on those numbers, but it's supposed to be very active. And like you say, this latest containment dome, if a hurricane comes along while they're there capturing that oil that's coming out of that, they have to go in to port, and that just leaves the oil, the now uncrimped oil, pouring into the Gulf. So in political news, Obama has sent Eric Holder down to the Gulf now, where he's talking to various attorneys general, which sounds to me like there may be criminal charges on the way. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I had heard, I tweeted on, I don't think I had time to post on it, some former EPA officials had made the case that already there should have been discussion of, a criminal investigation and potential charges. The investigation of what happened on the rig, on what people knew and what decisions they made and whether there's criminal liability, criminal malfeasance there, will take a lot of time to hash out. I'm sure any responsible agency has to be examining those options, those possibilities right now.
So what would a criminal charge against BP entail? Are those unlimited damages possibly at stake there?
Well, the first one would be involuntary or some other kind of manslaughter. Remember, 11 people died. So there's if there was some avoidable or, some decision that was made there that was knowingly made that would have increased the risk of those explosions happening, anything like that, that's the first question. And then you have the environmental liability questions as sort of a secondary and still obviously huge question on top of that.
I mean, obviously, there's this debate going on about raising the liability cap from $75 million, which is, beans, to $10 billion, but if we're being honest about it, the damages from this thing are way past $10 billion already, and who knows? I mean, if it's going and going until August, if it's going beyond that, I mean, you start to get to numbers that if BP has to really has to pay them, you're talking about BP's existence, ongoing existence as a company.
Yeah, can you imagine? Right? Yeah, I'm sure Exxon's considering, hey, can we buy them?
they're probably cheap right now.
Yeah, well, just today, this week, finally Wall Street kind of caught up with the reality that this is a significant drag on BP's prospects.
Yeah, and Robert Reich, former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, had a post today saying that the government should put BP into temporary receivership, basically take over the company temporarily. And then there are other people, around and about the internets who are talking about whether BP should just be nationalized, and really starting to raise larger questions about what exactly are the benefits of having private oil companies. Most of the big oil companies in the world are state-owned. Having this private oil industry is relatively speaking, a rare thing, and you know, it's not clear what we're getting out of that.
Boy, I could sure see Rush Limbaugh enjoying chewing on that idea. It would
finally some real socialism, right?
Yeah. Now we're really talking. Exactly. A little bank takeover here and there. That's different.
Yeah, that's one thing. Oil.
I just don't imagine. It took Obama's administration until now. You know, a full month and more had passed before they really stepped forward in a very concrete way and said, you know, we are in charge. My strong sense, and I wrote on this a little bit early on, was that they wanted to keep this at a distance. That they want, you know, it was easier politically by far to make this BP's problem, BP's failing, and to and even the mineral mismanagement services, as I called them, you know, you could point at least at the agency with all the vestiges of what Bush had done as being the problem. But finally, recently, there was this shift in the rhetoric from the White House to say, we really are in charge for all that entails, the good and the bad,
Yeah, you see that the daily briefings now are coming all from Thad Allen. There are no more BP daily briefings. There's a very conscious attempt to look like the government's taking over now, but it just looks to me like, you know, like they're chasing that they've gotten themselves stuck where they're chasing public perceptions now, and they can't quite get ahead of them. Like they started out slow, and now they just can't catch up. It's just bleeding them.
Yeah, I think you're right. And there were some people warning about that early on, that you got to just jump in. And this even is true. Well, of course, it's a no-brainer that it was true. BP, you know, with the sort of very minor, all that language, like very, very minor. And this is a tiny amount of oil in a very big ocean.
That was
ocean.
A sign that
you know, what were they thinking? What were they thinking just in terms
well,
of
just
public
this,
relations?
Just this weekend, Tony Hayward, the CEO of BP, said, I want my life back.
Oh, I love that,
you know,
yeah.
It's like 4.5 whatever million in salary and bonuses a year, I think, can probably, you know, compensate pretty well for the stresses of having to manage a public relations disaster, as opposed to a shrimp fisherman, which... You know, what are all those people going to do? That way of life is may very well be destroyed for good, and that's a whole subculture of the U.S. that's just uprooted now, and nobody has any idea what to do with those people.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's boy, oh boy. Yeah, again, whoever maybe he wasn't talking to any public relations people, but he sure should have been.
Yeah, and I just want to say, I know that. Probably the Obama administration is not really allowed to say this publicly because they'll get a lot of crap for it. But this really is, to a large extent, yet another disaster that Obama inherited. I mean, for 8 years of the Bush administration, this Minerals Management Service got worse and worse, more and more corrupt. Cozier and cozier with oil companies. And it's true that when Obama came in, he could have moved faster to clean it up. He could have really lit a fire under Salazar's ass and tried to do a whole scale cleaning. But if you're weighing sins in the eyes of history, I still think that Bush's, you know, degradation of government and government service ultimately is a bigger sin than failing to clean up Bush's degradation fast enough, you know? And that's true. It's true for the financial crisis. It's true for this oil thing. It's true for our reputation abroad. It's just, I wonder, in his quiet times, if Obama is just sort of stewing, wondering how he got stuck devoting his whole presidency to managing inherited disasters.
Well, I'm sure he knew, you know, some of these hadn't quite erupted, but he knew there were certainly a number of them that he was inheriting, and he knew that from the very get-go. So here's to him for taking that on. I guess it is someone has to be the first who's starting to shift the curve a little bit, and that comes with a lot of difficulties. We've even seen it. I know Jerome has. I know several other people have, and I know I have kind of drafted speeches for him. Here's your energy speech. Here's your, right. You know, here's the way to do it. And but when I've talked to senior administration officials who are saddled with so many other simultaneous challenges, and you know, there's a lot of frustration within the administration over not being able to give that speech, you know, even if it is,
really?
Seems like the perfect moment from the standpoint.
Yes,
of
I think
like
this is the world, at least the environmental world, as you know, has been wondering. You know, there's been a lot of criticism, not just from environmentalists, but Paul Krugman and Tom Friedman and other people saying Obama's not using this disaster to push any positive legislative agenda on energy. And you know, in his press conference the other day, he mentioned that there's this bill before the Senate and this should inspire them to pass it, and he supports that. But it sounded like pretty pro forma language to me. He still hasn't really seemed to come out in a strong, really impassioned way and tried to pivot from this to doing something good on energy. So what explains that? Why do you think that is? I find it pretty baffling.
I guess it's probably from the lens of it's shaped, his outer day-to-day messaging is shaped more by his uber political handlers than by his energy and climate and science team, and even perhaps the economics people. It's just that they're looking at the fall elections, they're looking at subtleties of which races are in play and that kind of thing in ways that I frankly, that's Adam Nagorny's job here, you know, at the Times and others to suss out. And you know, I'm focused, as you are, mainly on this one smallish, you know, an important part of this bigger arena. What I had heard just last week, I was in Washington at a meeting on climate and ran into a number of folks from the administration there. And essentially there's, I guess you'd say even within the administration, there's some tension about that notion that this is the moment and this is the message. And I guess maybe they're waiting. I don't know if they're waiting. I'm sure Grist wrote on the, I hadn't had time, but I'm sure Grist wrote on the polls showing now an uptick in concern about offshore drilling and an uptick in concern
sharp
about the environment.
Uptick.
Yeah. So if that sustains, you might see someone, you know, the balance tipping toward now is the time. Oil prices, by the way, are still lower than they were a few months ago. So there isn't that pump imperative that there was during the presidential election, you know, when McCain and everybody was talking about a gas tax holiday, and Obama
right.
courageously said, no, we shouldn't do that. There isn't that imperative right now, the price imperative. And actually, you know, right now, I just before I broke to do this chat with you, I was drafting a post for .earth on, you know, just how utterly disengaged we are still as a country from the need for an energy quest. And when I use that term, I'm talking about both the efficiency side, you know, what I can do questing within my own life to make
mm-hmm.
Energy choices. You know, I was at the supermarket this morning and walking through the frozen food aisle, and there's still no doors on the frozen food cabinets. You know, some of them do and some of them don't. So we're basically refrigerating the earth in, you know, in every supermarket in America where you have
mm-hmm.
an open cabinet, which is basically saying bye. You know, you don't have to have the inconvenience of opening a door to get your frozen ravioli. You know, in my own house here, it's an old farmhouse. Last year, I was dealing with the reality that the oil tank in the basement, the heating oil tank, was rusting and needed to replace it. I'm thinking, now's the moment. Now is my moment, you know, like Obama's moment. to really grapple with this energy challenge. But when I looked at the options, geothermal would be tens of thousands of dollars for me. And Amory Lovins sent me an email saying, well, it just harvest efficiency. That's the best way. Make your house super tight. And we've kind of sort of done that. So, you know, here I am living on oil and shopping in markets with open refrigerated cabinets. And I'm grumpy that Obama hasn't made this our moment. You know what I mean? It's like it's sort of. There's something
it's you know, I hear what you're saying about his political advisors. If you read, I don't know if you've read yet, it comes out this month, but the book by Eric Pooley, former Time magazine journalist Eric Pooley, who's at Business Week now, I think, but he wrote a book called The Climate War about this, you know, decades-long quest to pass a climate change bill and deal with this. But he did some reporting, you know, some inside reporting over the course of the Obama administration, and it's always been the case that Obama and Carol Browner and John Holdren and those people get the climate crisis. And you know, early in his administration, in his campaign, Obama said, this is one of three issues that I'm staking the success of my presidency on, health care, climate, and Iraq. And so, but there's always been this pushback from the political people, from Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod, who just think it's the time's not right and the politics aren't quite there yet. And that's been true ever since before the House started developing a climate bill. They were tepid about that until Rahm Emanuel and Nancy Pelosi, until Nancy Pelosi and Henry Waxman forced their hand by putting the bill on the floor. And then Obama finally, you know, got up and started doing some vote stumping. But then they saw what happened after the House bill passed, that dreadful summer of 2009 when the Tea Party were, you know, invading the town halls and House members were getting beat up for it. And it just reinforced their sense that the politics aren't right. But this is, to me, it's a weirdly passive view of the situation. You know, things are not just going to line up so that Obama can step in and tap the putt into the hole. You know, he... Part of what's going to change the national mood, part of what's going to reframe the way people approach this, is Obama's lead. I mean, he's the most powerful politician in the world, the greatest orator in that office in years, and he has the power to change the political landscape. But he just doesn't want to seem to get out ahead. But that's leadership. I mean, right now, if you're going to get out with that message, you know, like you're talking about, America is not yet connected the energy quest as something that's not just replacing oil. It's not just new ways of doing electricity. It's across all sectors, all people, all of society, a national imperative. And the only way they're going to hear that is if their national leader tells them so. And if he's not going to do it now, you know, when's he ever going to do it?
I know, and even if his political folks feel that there isn't adequate support or an adequate frame for putting in that component of the climate legislation that's, you know, an explicit restriction on greenhouse gases or the trade, you know, whether it's cap and trade or some rising price of some other source, you would think rather than letting that dribble along, they would come up with a new alternative approach. You know, Obama could, and I kind of thought last year, you know, okay, he'll let Congress sort of hash this out, the energy, the shape of the bill the first year, and then he'll come riding in the congressional re-election year this year and come in with his proposal. And, you know, as you say, that's the thing that hasn't happened, whatever it might be. And I do think there's a way for him perhaps to even make the case. And you and I might differ on this. I mean, we've kind of differed on how much in the forefront climate should be in the past. That there's a way to frame this new – that the country needs a new relationship with energy, period. And there are many reasons. There's the security reason. There's the economics of this century are different than the economics of the fossil centuries before.
Sure.
And there's the climate risk that builds with every year's increase in concentrations of this gas in the atmosphere. And that requires a new age. you know, the rhetoric's all there. You, me, others have written imagined approaches to this that seem like no-brainers. And that's where, I guess, you know, here we are. We just circle back to the question of someone in the White House is reading the politics as not finding a logic to that.
Well, and it's sort of funny. We tend, as people sort of outside D.C., to want to defer to these political experts that Obama has on his team. Like, surely they know something we don't. Surely they have all the poll numbers and everything. But clearly, whatever they're doing, it's not working. I think it's ridiculous to call this Obama's Katrina, but it's shaping up to be something like Obama's Iran hostage crisis, which is just this slow bleed that makes him look powerful and out of touch. And so whatever they thought they were doing with this sort of tepid, cautious, one step behind, put the focus on BP kind of response, clearly that wasn't the right way to go. So maybe they're not as, you know, maybe they're not as savvy as all that. I actually wrote on the blog the other day, you know, there is this big, massive conflict over this climate and energy bill that's been developing for ages and is now before the Senate. But even putting that aside, there are tons and tons and tons of small bore initiatives focused purely on oil that Obama could suggest and push right now. Like, not everything has to be about that one big bill. There are plenty of things that could encourage conservation, that could encourage efficiency. He could boost the CAFE standards further. He could, you know, there's literally thousands of small steps you could take to start to conserve oil, but he's not talking about any of those.
I know. Well, and again, that kind of leaves us wondering. I wish when he had his first press conference in 335 days, I could have asked a question. I'm sure you could too. It's challenging. And again,
well, I asked Carol Browner on a conference call the other day, and you know, she just sort of, it's the same thing. She just says, we support efforts to develop a comprehensive bill. They're just, you know, it's very pro forma.
Well, in a way, that's kind of the same approach they've had to BP. In other words, it's Congress's problem. And here it's BP's problem, and the bill is Congress's problem.
But the problem, in one sense, is that during the health care fight, you know, it went on and on and on in Congress, and everybody was wondering, when is Obama going to come in? And you know, this thing is bogging down in Congress, and then Scott Brown won, and everybody thought it was dead. And then, toward the end, Obama came in and really did it. You know, it was a joint address to Congress, getting out in town halls, traveling constantly. It was on the tip of his tongue every time he talked to the press. So now we know what it looks like, right? We know what it looks like when Obama wants something, when he really wants something. So there's no way for them to pretend now that Obama supports a climate bill unless he is doing what we saw him do. So what's your take on the current politics of the climate bill? Early on, right after the spill, there was this, you know, the sort of consensus seemed to be, oddly, that this makes a climate bill less likely, because one of the sort of fragile deals that was holding the coalition together was this deal on offshore drilling, and clearly that's blown up now. Menendez and Nelson and Lautenberg are out if offshore drilling provisions remain. So, but now that it's gone on so long and it's so huge, it seems like maybe we're getting near something that's slightly paradigm shifting. So what's your take on the current state of play?
I'm not kind of a good predictor, but I don't foresee a bill coming to his desk for signature this year. I think last year everyone said that was an artificial expectation anyway. Maybe someone's still feeling that this year. It's just unrealistic. And by the way, this gives him also the chance still to frame the climate and energy challenge for what it is. It's a challenge of our time, not meaning his presidency, even not meaning our generation alone, even. In fact, I've heard some people say, I recently alluded to the Kennedy speech at Rice University about articulating his argument for going to the moon. And that's clearly not the precise It's not like this challenge. In fact, some people have said this is more like the Cold War than anything else, in the sense that it has to be sustained, multifaceted approach to energy and environmental policy for decades to really tip the needle on emissions in a meaningful way, and also to find ways to have that happen globally, which is, of course, the really huge question. So he could, you know, in theory, looking at the challenge in Congress on closing a bill, looking at, as you said, the no-brainers on oil, and not just oil, on many aspects of, as I said, on the supermarkets, you know, with the unenclosed freezer sections, to get started with some of those success stories right away as a way to build public involvement and engagement in the long-haul challenge of building a prospering world that's less dependent on polluting forms of energy. There's a way to articulate it. There's a way to say, you know, Congress, there's enough complexity here that let's just stand back for a second and let's just take another stab at this and find some way to get a broader consensus on the things that really matter. And again, the energy imperative. Now, I said, and again, some people disagree with me out there in the blog world. I did a piece. My first piece as an opinion writer was said basically, if you had for your Prius, if you had the money to own a Prius, we're lucky enough to have one. If you had a choice of only one bumper sticker, and it could be climate crisis or energy quest, which would you put on your bumper if you thought it would kind of harness your neighbor's interests? And, you know, an energy quest is sort of forward-looking, positive, active adventure. Climate crisis is sort of like how we defined pollution problems way back in the 20th century. It was all negative and restrictive and regulatory and litigious. And I think you can get the language for an energy quest that incorporates the realities of what would need to happen to restrict greenhouse gas emissions far more easily than you could the other way around. You know, and Al Gore, for all of his hard work, much of which I think was valuable, I think the meme of climate crisis has to go away.
Well,
it's not just a meme. I mean, it's more than a meme. You know, it's a challenge.
It is, in fact, a crisis.
Yeah, no, it's a phenomenon. You know, but actually, language does matter.
Yeah, this discussion is ongoing, as you know, it has been going on for quite a while. And the one point I would want to make about it, and I wrote about this a few months back, is we need to keep two conversations separate. One is the conversation about politics, about framing, about what language we use, about what kind of, how we want the public to think about this, how we want to sell legislation to the public, all that stuff, the political conversation. But then there's the policy conversation, which is what legislative and policy mechanisms are going to be required to do what needs to be done. And I feel like a lot of times Democrats conflate those. They decide that the politics need to be different, and so they try to change policy to change the politics. And as I tried to argue on the blog, I think we're sort of in an era now of post-truth politics. Like the politics are no longer particularly attached to the policy. And if you want illustration of this, look at the fact that there's an entire movement in the country right now that's up in arms battling socialism, which bears no relationship whatsoever to what is in fact happening. You know, there's no argument that what's happening on a policy level is in fact anything resembling socialism, but what the right seems to instinctively get that the left doesn't is that it doesn't matter what's really happening. The policy is, in a sense, irrelevant to the politics. For political purposes, what the right has decided to do is meet everything Obama and the Democrats try to do with maximal, full-throated, full-volume denunciations of America-hating and socialism and whatever else. That's true independent of what the policy in question happens to be. So if Dems, you know, if the left can accept that, get beyond the sort of enlightenment view of what politics ought to be and accept the fact that we're in post-truth politics, then you start to see a road whereby you can fight the political battle on political grounds in terms of messaging, in terms of coalitions and advertisements and things like that. And then you do the policy separately. You do the policy based on what's going to work, right? You don't go around fiddling with your policy trying to make right-wingers say different things. That's not going to work. You do the policy based on what's going to work and the politics based on what's going to work. So this is my, you know, this is it's one thing to say that, it's another thing to internalize it, but my point is, I'm all getting around to my point, which is on policy grounds, on purely policy grounds, I think a declining cap on greenhouse gases is incredibly important. I think putting a cap on greenhouse gases, a declining cap, into statutory law is going to be the foundation on which all these many, 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 many future battles are fought. So anything you want to do to reduce oil use, or anything you want to do to incentivize supermarkets to close their freezer doors, anything you want to do is strengthened by having this cap in law. That's what you stand on to fight all your other battles. So I agree that maybe the climate language needs to recede, but I don't necessarily agree that we need to turn in policy making purely towards the energy side of things. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Although, again, now I'll switch back to the politics. I just don't think the politics is even close to being at the point of getting a true declining cap passed. You could get a cap. Remember how the environmental movement several years ago was dead set on no safety valve. Safety valve meaning no, like, wiggle room. You know, that if it got a little costly, then you just sort of let out a little of the air. And that there were all these kind of demands at that time that have all eroded away. Now there's, I don't know what the offsets are. This is, you know, ways to kind of get to your goals using things other than actually reductions in direct reductions of emissions. The agricultural offsets and the forest subsidies. And those things are highly dubious. So, and I was just at this meeting last week where people who really understand forest science and agriculture were saying they're dubious. They're basically politically vital, but climatologically potentially meaningless. And if we have a bill that, if the only way to get a bill through that has a quote unquote cap, but it's so weakened by these kinds of mechanisms that the climate will never notice it, or at least won't notice it in time, quote unquote, is perhaps worse, because then you get all the headlines, you get the victory, you get the signing ceremony, and everyone's off the hook for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years. So that concerns me, that and the politics of a hard cap, meaning one where you can say 80 by 2050, 80% reduction in CO2 emissions by 2050, and actually mean it in an enforced way, is, to me, pie in the sky. It's just not there.
Well, this I agree that the cap that's in play right now is it's just set too low. It's not particularly ambitious. I mean, I think there's a decent chance we'll hit 17% by 2020, just by virtue of a crappy economy and less driving. And you're right that there are right now 2 billion tons of offsets allowed under that cap by 2020. I think the offsets conversation has gotten a little confused. I think some of them are dubious, but I think the oversight mechanisms on offsets, in part in response to a lot of these concerns, are quite stiff in the American Power Act, number one. And number two, I think the people I talk to about offsets, the really wonk modelers, the energy, you know, the people who are following the energy markets, think that the notion that there are going to be 2 billion tons of offsets to come out of the woodwork between now and 2020 is just fantasy. There's just not going to be enough available. But anyway, setting those concerns about the cap aside, the tactical question then is, which are you better off doing? Passing a weak and a weak cap with too many loopholes now, and fighting to improve that cap and remove the loopholes in the ensuing 10 years, or are you better off waiting until the politics are ripe for a real hard cap? That to me is the tactical question. It's not about whether you love this particular cap, because I don't think anybody in the environmental world has any illusions that this is the kind of cap we're ultimately going to need. Just the question is, do you take a step now, or do you wait until you're until the politics are ripe. And I'm of the opinion that one of the things that's going to make the politics ripe is action, is people actually starting to do stuff, you know, starting to respond to these new incentives. And that's not going to happen until you get some kind of bill in place.
Yeah.
I know this is controversial in the environmental world, to say the least.
I know, and you know, then there's the other guys out there who are pushing really hard to make sure this doesn't get full traction among the sort of the Lugar vote. I was at a meeting early, maybe it was last year, or no, it was this year after Copenhagen, with a bunch of people, including someone from Senator Lugar's office, who's sort of his energy environment guy, and he was describing the Lugar voter, and these are not, you know, Rush Limbaugh.
Right.
Worshippers. They're much more subtle than that. But they have there is a libertarian streak. They really don't see this as reasonable. They do care about energy. Here's one of the reasons I think it's important to keep focused on energy efficiency and these sort of no-brainers, at least as and I know you are. I mean, I know we all, you know, anyone who looks at this rationally is. But this Six Americas study that was done came out a year or so ago that was sort of a portrait of why people think the way they think about global warming and energy. They had these little bubbles. There were six bubbles there. Each one is the size of that constituent, that group. There's the dismissive bubble, the alarmed bubble, the disengaged. And they're all really low or kind of right toward the equator on things like cap and trade. And then when you mention, would you support incentives for buying an energy efficient appliance or car, they all, including the dismissives, the folks who completely reject that global warming is a real thing, they all go up. And on my blog, among the commenters, a very variegated crew there, it's hard to find someone who doesn't support using energy more carefully and all those kinds of things. So there is a constituency out there, even among the sort of Lugar Republican, and even as that poll showed, among those some of those who stridently reject the kind of climate crisis conception or the science itself, there is a strong pull toward the natural logic of using things thriftily.
And this has been true in every poll for ages, right? I mean, the public loves clean energy. I mean, they love, if you just ask flat out, do you support helping out solar and wind and other forms of clean energy? They love that. They love energy efficiency. They always have. That's always been the high poll numbers. But I would question, I mean, this Lugar voter, you know, it's not for the first time. I wish I could just sort of sit down with one of them, because I'm puzzled. I'm puzzled by this notion that handing out a bunch of incentives, which is, you know, the sort of polite policy word for subsidies, handing out a bunch of subsidies to this and that industry is somehow more conservative or more libertarian than pricing an unpriced externality into the market and raising revenue before you spend it. Both those, which only happen if you have a price on carbon, you integrate the externality into the market and you raise revenue that you can then spend on these incentives. Both those seem more conservative to me, more in line with a libertarian philosophy than the alternative. So one of the things that's happened, it seems like the politics of this, the way we talk about it, has gotten completely catawampus. This is cap and trade is essentially a conservative. It's a conservative approach. That's why the elder Bush, you know, bought onto it and passed it.
Well, we'll see. I don't think there are any easy answers here, as is clear just in our chat. And the elder Bush only bought into it for sulfur and, you know, conventional pollutants, which are a tiny, tiny portion of the cost of generating electricity compared to dealing with the CO2. Which is a much more fundamental byproduct and harder to, as we know, if you wanted to capture it, you know, in meaningful quantities and stick it somewhere. That alone is a huge challenge just in terms of the energy and cost of doing it. So it's like a whole different, the realm of CO2 and is so different than the realm of the traditional environmental challenges that we surmounted pretty effectively in the 20th century, and where there was bipartisanship. The thing that's gone away was there in abundance. You know, the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, that was all Nixon era stuff. And what made those things different? Well, there were several things. One was, you know, the Hudson River, where I live here, was full of crap, sewage floating by. And so anyone could see viscerally the problem. And then you could have a huge constituency to invest in the solution, like sewage treatment plants, because unions liked it, big business liked it, cement manufacturers liked it. And it was, and you could have a change in your time. In 1996, we wrote this series of stories about the revival of the Hudson River. And air, you know, the old air pollutants were a different beast as well. And this one is a bigger bear. And then you have this, now you have the globalization of these environmental problems where, you know, there's this argument that, well, even if we had a big bill, if China doesn't get inspired, and why really should they, even though some say they might, to then, well, they did it, so now we'll do it. You know, their use in coal is growing far faster than their explosive investments in solar and wind. So it's kind of getting that, you know, the argument that, well, our industry, the polluting industry, will just move over to China or India in this case, you know, increasingly, then adds another impediment to the logic for the conventional approach.
I think that international argument is shifting rapidly. I don't think the political conversation about it in the U.S. has caught up with the reality anymore. And I mean, in China, as you know, it's sort of, China is like a study in contrast to the U.S. right now, because their use of coal is growing rapidly while ours is roughly steady, but their use of renewable energy is also growing rapidly while ours is you know, growing much, much less rapidly. So, you know, everything there is bigger and faster, but what they have there that I think is lacking here is a sense of the big picture and a plan. They have a 5-year plan. They have a 10-year plan. They're very consciously pushing all these, you know, these regional sort of Communist Party officials to reduce energy use in their regions, to build out as much renewables as possible. And they're trying to find out if they can pull off this clean energy transition while still managing enough growth to keep their, you know, to keep their Communist Party from being overwhelmed by circumstances. But they've got an eye on the big picture, and they're trying. And I suspect that what will happen is China will eventually find that that the economics are shifting, and that China will get more ambitious with experience. That's my prediction. But we aren't experiencing anything, so we're not going to get more ambitious. What we're doing is sitting on our asses. And, you know, you were talking about things that have changed since the era of bipartisanship and actual action. I mean, one of the things that's changed is this, you know, the Republican Party has decided to act like a parliamentary party, to unite lockstep in opposition to everything, which is fine if you're in a parliamentary system like, you know, like every other developed democracy has, you know, that they'll be out of power and we'll come into power and we'll implement our policies. And if voters don't like us, then they'll, you know, vote us out. But here you have one party acting like a parliamentary party, but then you have all these mechanisms in our system of government whereby they can completely halt progress. So one of those has to change. Either the Republican Party has to snap out of this sort of Tea Party frenzy of craziness, or the rules have to change. And that means the filibuster in the Senate and anonymous holds in the Senate and all sorts of, I mean, you can imagine all sorts of other things that could change. But right now, the U.S. is just paralyzed. That's the worst thing about all this, is we just can't seem to do anything, not even the wrong things. We just can't do anything.
This leads to an uncomfortable question. Something I've heard floated by a few political analysts I've talked to is that meaningful climate and energy legislation really is only possible, would only be possible, given these dynamics under a Republican president. I don't know whether you've dwelled on that or asked that question. But it's, when you think about it, you know, because then the Republican brings, he has enough power within his party to bring, or her party to bring actually, that would be interesting, to bring along, you know, enough votes, and would always get the Democratic votes because it was progressive legislation.
That's possible, but I feel like, in a sense, that, and this is part of what I feel like Lindsey Graham didn't really understand, and I think maybe that Lugar doesn't really understand, and that this notion of Lugar voters, I feel like those older kind of dons of the Republican Party who were slightly more moderate or at least more open to the occasional bipartisan action and thought of themselves as kind of representing the business world, you know, business friendly against these kind of, you know, quasi-socialist Democrats. That model of the Republican Party, I think, has shifted under their feet, and I'm not sure they get it yet. The Tea Party has taken over. And you can see this in the shift in rhetoric about the climate bill. Now there's more and more businesses coming out in favor of this climate bill, as you know, thousands of them, including some very, very big players in the energy world and GE and et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's sort of becoming more and more fair to characterize the business world as in favor of this shift because they want the predictability. And the Republican Party is attacking those businesses as you know, just seeking rents and, you know, trying to manipulate the political process. I don't think the Republican Party is – I think those Lugar voters are disempowered in the Republican Party right now. So I kind of think if the Republicans took over, even a Republican president who wanted to do something like this – right now, isn't those elders of the Republican Party aren't in control of their party anymore, I don't think.
Yeah. So I'm not sure it could happen. Yeah. One of the most consistently aggravating things in the rhetoric on energy lately has been the utter lack of an argument by Republicans, by those who are, you know, calling this Obama's Katrina. I haven't seen anyone articulate a counter energy policy, with or without a climate component, unless I've missed something. I mean, I don't track this as closely, the Washington stuff, as closely as you or Kate Shepard or others do. Am I missing something? Is there another energy policy out there?
You're not missing anything. Insofar as the Republican Party overall has an energy position, all it's just sort of these bromides about all the above, which in practice generally translate to handing out subsidies to whatever industries are big enough to lobby, and give money to the Republican Party. There is no coherent policy approach to energy on the right anymore. I mean the actual right. I mean, there are tons and tons of conservative-leaning intellectuals, as you know, I'm sure you've talked to many of them over the year, who have all kinds of great plans. But in terms of the institutional Republican Party, I don't think there's anything that can be called a coherent energy strategy. I mean, if you look at Newt Gingrich's, you know, he has a book out. He had a book out about green conservatism or something like that. But if you dig down and look at the details, it's just making big pots of money available to private companies. That's sort of the beginning and the end of it. And that's, you know, I'm sure I don't have to tell you, that's not going to get us. Not going to get us there.
Yeah.
Well,
this is an upbeat conversation.
Yeah, I know. Should we end on a note of optimism? Do you have any notes of optimism?
Well, the Minerals Mismanagement Service is being renovated.
Yes, another retroactive policy after. This is like taking your shoes off at the airport, right? Responding to the previous disaster.
I am personally going to really reappraise my oil tank question, even though I already did buy a replacement. So that's good.
Yeah, my oil furnace is nearing 60 years old, so I'm looking at a replacement too. And just like you, I looked at the super efficient, you know, heat exchange takes, and the guy who came to assess it said, "Yeah, it'll pay itself back in about 20 years or so." It's like we'll be living in post-apocalyptic times by then.
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, some of that reality also is what leads me back more than some others to the need to incorporate into whatever the argument, whatever the plan is, a big push on direct push on innovation, as well as everything else that would need to happen to use standards and everything else, have some kind of price on pollution, but to really remind the country how utterly disengaged in the energy inquiry we are, that compared to what the things that interest us in other realms. When you look at the amounts of money that are are thoughtlessly invested. It's huge. It's tens of billions. And here on the frontiers of energy, under the frontiers of energy science, it's tiny, tiny. Back in 2006, I quoted John Holdren, a paper he wrote, the science advisor to Obama now, where he said, you know, a 2.5 cent, you know, absolutely invisible tweak in the gas tax would triple our energy research and development money. And you know, here we are arguing about, you know, caps and of tens of billions and hundreds of billions of dollars of money flows, and we're not even remotely engaged, even in that little tiny arena, which is a part of what has to happen if we really want to have more options for you and me to have, you know, a new oil burner or whatever.
Right. Well, one note of optimism is that Andy Revkin has been freed from the strictures of traditional reporting, and is now living on the opinion page. So what can we expect from the unshackled Andy Revkin over the next year? Are you going to try to put together some sort of coherent philosophy, or
yeah, for sure. And I've articulated some of it recently in the initial post, and some stuff I wrote. My version of the Obama speech was a week or two ago, but on the international frontier as well. How can we meaningfully divert trends in India and China? Remember, India is the new China. India will have 2 billion people in 2050 as China's population is flat. How can you engage those places in transitions away from fossil fuels that are still abundant there? That's a key part of what I'll be looking at too. And there too, you know, back in February, I wrote a piece, even before I was an opinionator, on the end of the Copenhagen model, the idea that we'll have a binding cap, where legally binding, those words are going to go away. There's Thomas Schelling, a famous economist, talks about soft law. You'll be seeing a lot more soft law and less of the idea of hard binding things, particularly on the international level. I just don't see it ever. You'll never have another Kyoto-style agreement. Now, that's separate from the flows of money for adaptation and that kind of
thing. Sure.
That's a different kind of
contract. Yeah, we're entering the wild, wild west, it seems, in a lot of different fronts. These will be interesting times to be an opinionator, if nothing else.
I guess there you go.
All right.
That's why I still have my guitar behind me. You can't see it.
Exactly. When all else fails.
Yeah. Right. I'll go on the streets and sing Liberated Carbon, my son.
Right. All right. Well, thanks for taking the time, Andy. It was fun.
Yeah, and you too. This is great. I always enjoy this. Take care.
All right. We'll do it again sometime.
All right. Bye
now.